I am Reese Tisdale, and this is Future Water, which we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, I'm going to be joined by John Berryman, who is kind enough to work through some recent research on California drought mitigation strategies. We just put out some research on what's happening not only in domestic water usage, which seems to be in stark contrast to the governor's mandates, as well as Metropolitan Water District and LADWPs. Talk a little bit about desalination in the U.S., but also what's happening with the Huntington Beach large-scale seawater desalination plant being developed by Poseidon Water. And then lastly, we talk a little bit about Lake Powell, Lake Mead, and the Glen Canyon Dam, and the fact that if Californians don't care about water now, they're going to, because they may have blackouts because of a drought and lack of water in the Western U.S. So with that, let's jump into the conversation with John and get it started.
Reese, thanks for having me back on the podcast. It's good to see you.
Yeah, I think this is this back-to-back? Did we do this again a couple of weeks ago? Nice.
I didn't feel like a regular.
Yeah. Could be your podcast.
We are slightly less nasally, I would say, than the last podcast. So,
Yes. Wow. Short memory. I have. I forgot about that. It's a new world. So, and everything's better. So I'll let you kick it off.
Yeah. Let's jump in. Today, if anybody's reading newspapers and following along, I think California drought conditions has been under assessment for a long time, and we're seeing more and more headlines. I thought that this was probably a good time to provide our perspective on kind of what's happening and then just see where we see things heading in the future. So last week, there was an announcement of the Poseidon Waters Huntington Beach desal plant, large-scale desal, that was rejected. We are talking about different reservoirs, Lake Powell, Lake Mead, that are at extremely low positions right now, which is going to impact hydroelectric power. And that can obviously ripple out to affecting millions and millions of people in California. I think every single county in California, all 58, is under a drought emergency proclamation right now. So that obviously lends itself to discussions around conservation from both the residential and commercial side. So a lot to unpack, but I figure let's just give you the mic for a couple of minutes and just take us through in any orderly fashion that you can what you think is going on right now.
Yeah, I think so. Thanks for that intro. And this is interesting. One, because it allows us to unpack a lot of things. You're exactly right. There are a lot of things happening not only within California, but within the West as a whole, both, like you said, drought. So California is in drought. It seems to have been this way really since the founding of Bluefield Research, which has been the better part of a decade, that California has been under some kind of water stress. You know, and I think it really came to head over the past couple of weeks because we've been looking at water usage data. Truth be told, it's somewhat natural that when we get into a drought, water usage goes up because people don't have the rains to water their lawns. So they then turn to other sources, whether it be municipal sources, but also groundwater withdrawals for things like agriculture as well. So water usage in California has been climbing, but it's also up almost 20% from where this time in 2020. So it's jump dramatically. Now, this is happening amidst voluntary requests for water conservation from the governor in California. And it's sort of, we're running in two different directions. The government and the administration and state policymakers are saying, hey, everybody needs to conserve water. But in fact, no one seems to be doing that. And it sets us on an uncomfortable path going forward. I wouldn't even say it's dramatically different. If anything, we've been heading in this direction for a while and no one seems to want to address the light at the end of the tunnel. As some might say, it's unfortunately a train coming our way, not actual light at the end of the tunnel.
I mean, are we basically seeing firsthand that without a mandate in place, it's just not going to happen? People just aren't going to voluntarily do this kind of...
Yeah, I don't think they will. And I think it works, right? And we were talking a little bit before we jumped on this call, and that is, you know, the mandates in 2014, 2015 pretty much worked, right? There were penalties in place where the more than 400 urban water systems were tasked with managing water usage, and there were penalties put in place, and the target was 25%. And overall, the state hit, I think, 23.9, 24%, pretty close to. So almost hit the targeted mandate, which is great, a great achievement. Now, the challenge to that is that success has potentially made it harder to achieve additional conservation targets. But all indications are under the voluntary targets, there's no reduction. In fact, I shouldn't even say hour. We're both on the East Coast, but hey, we're all on this together. The water usage has gone up. So I think mandates do work. We're also in a unique political environment. Is it unique anymore? But we've had lockdowns, shutdowns, COVID, masks, et cetera, et cetera. I think people are tired of the man, as some may call him or her, the government, telling them what to do. I think there's a little bit of that. And I think there's just a reality check that needs to happen about the severity of what is in fact happening. And not to get ahead of ourselves here, but we may find out this summer when there's no power or they're rolling blackouts, which we can get into in a minute. So now, that being said, there are certain places like Metropolitan Water District, LADWP, they've started implementing lawn watering measures, you know, one day a week, 2 days a week. But at this point, as we've seen in places like Las Vegas, you know, at some point the city or the state or someone has to come in and say, quit watering your lawn, get rid of the lawns, get rid of the swimming pool. I mean, if you want the world, that's not critical to our lives. Otherwise, it's going to get a lot more expensive.
Well, can I just tackle that for a second with you as well? So we are talking about residential, you know, residents using less water, but how much of an impact is that actually going to have on the whole? Like, how big of a slice of the pie is that as opposed to, you know, the industrial sectors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in and of itself is a problem. I mean, residential or urban water usage represents about 8% of the total pie in California. So pretty small, right? But it's also probably the place or the segment in which there can be notable strides or gains made, right? You can point to users. Agriculture, which makes up the lion's share of water usage, not only in California, but just globally speaking, it's all very sort of, I don't know, non-point source. You know, it's groundwater withdrawals, it's surface water usage. I mean, there's irrigation from, you know, it's coming from a lot of different places, and it's hard to put your finger on, and also to say, hey, you've got to stop that. Now, there are issues. What ends up happening is groundwater is withdrawn, and there's also things like land subsidence. In some areas, there could be saltwater intrusion into aquifers because of overdrawing. We definitely see that in Florida and the East Coast and other parts. But yeah, the urban water usage is a small share, to your point. But that being said, it's still an area that people need to focus on.
So also, it's probably the area where you can make a handbrake turn and have a bit of a quicker response as opposed to all the things that go into an agricultural industrial change for water usage is probably a lot more hard to go through and work through as opposed to just telling everybody to use less water.
Exactly. And then you also have the water rights issues in the West, and that's a whole nother, you know, ball of wax that complicates things and how water usage, but, you know, things like State Water Project in California and these large water conveyances. I mean, you know, the allocations have been cut back. You know, the Colorado River at the same time is pretty low these days. So we've seen more recently that, you know, farmers in Arizona, they're not going to get their allocations as well because of things like drought and the impacts of climate. So you're right. A handbrake is a good way to put it. You can sort of point at the domestic or residential light commercial users and say, hey, can we improve this? And there are technologies and solutions out there to not only help them reduce water usage, but also even to amplify supply.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So obviously we're talking about using less water. There are solutions in place to increase supply. And I guess that's maybe where we can start talking about the desal market a little bit in the US. I mean, boy, it seems funny that this would come at this time, right? Last week is when they reject a large scale desal plant. Why now, when we're talking about such little supply of water? Don't we need everything that we can get?
One would think. So it's more complicated than just saying Southern California or Orange County, in this case, they're in a drought, therefore they should do whatever it takes to add supply. In all fairness to those opposed to the desal plant, they are doing things like wastewater reuse where they're recharging aquifers. So they have implemented other solutions to augment their supplies. At the same time, I think, you know, as we've learned in places like Australia, you kind of, or San Diego for that matter, which is where the largest desal plant in the US is, also developed by Poseidon Water, is that, you know, it does provide somewhat of an insurance policy. Like this challenge is not going away, and it is the most expensive water out there. Let's not kid ourselves. I get it. So our take is this is probably a last gasp for a large scale desal in the US. Quite honestly, there's not a lot of, you know, you may see some in places like Florida, but it's slow going. These projects are, you know, this Huntington Beach one, it was going to cost over $1 billion. And they are alternatives. Like I said, wastewater reuse is a more cost-effective solution. The challenge with that is you can reclaim and reuse wastewater all day long, but you have to have somewhere, you have to find off-takers, you have to move it to where it needs to be. Are others willing to use it? Will it be potable? Will it be just for irrigation? There's a lot of complexity about sort of the buyer and seller arrangements on the back end of that. But also this Huntington Beach project, it's been in development for more than 2 decades. So if we can't come to terms at this point after 2 decades, several droughts, then I hate to say give up the dream. It's frustrating because there's hundreds of desal plants all over the world, whether it be the Middle East, whether it be Spain, whether it be Chile for the mining industry, or Australia. They work. The technology works. If the pushback is cost, well, I'm a little concerned that, you know, well, quite honestly, probably in a place like California, water should cost more given that it's not raining very much and the snowpack levels are pretty low. So I would say, if anything, it's a little frustrating to say that it's gotten to this point. And the pushback has really been a couple things. That would be, one, the cost. Is the supply needed? Now, I think there's some people definitely have maybe a good argument that it's not needed. They have alternative supplies, but also the environmentalist, whether it be, you know, disturbance to the seabed and what it means for, you know, wildlife and such. But it the tone, if anything, is a little strange about rejecting the permit after so long. So
as a result, I mean, I guess we've been looking at water reuse for a long time, and that's also nothing new, but I mean, are those projects that we're tracking, they're proliferating, right? There's a lot more of them coming up, and not only just in these southwestern kind of water stressed states, but other regions as well, right? Isn't that what we've been noticing?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I'd say if anything, the last drought was really a boon for wastewater reuse. I mean, I think a lot, you know, we look at wastewater projects, that the project pipeline, and I think we have you know, we put our research, say over 650, almost 700 projects that we've seen. A big chunk of that is, in fact, in California, or really just the West as a whole. It's really in about 9 states where you're seeing it. That would also include Florida. They've got their own sort of water stress issue, like I mentioned earlier about aquifer over withdrawals and salinity in the water supply. But, you know, it is, if anything, a drought has been the catalyst for that. It is, you know, the water is being treated. In many cases, it's just going into ocean. It's basically treated to potable standards and sent to an ocean outfall and out into the ocean. And hey, that's, you know, so to not reuse or reclaim wastewater supply is, given the state of the world and where we see things happening, is kind of crazy. And that people have been really innovative. You know, it's, you know, the supplies have been used for everything, for data centers to power plants to just cooling systems for industrial facilities to drinking water, so potable drinking water. I think if we haven't gotten beyond the ickiness factor of drinking, you know, reclaimed and treated wastewater, which is, in my argument, is cleaner than what's sitting in the reservoir, then we'll be forced to. And I think that the next real wave that we're seeing is, one, the move for industrial and commercial facilities to do so, but also as it will migrate eastward because there are other types of water stresses east. And so, hey, let's give it to California for setting the stage for that eastward expansion in this case.
Totally. And on the corporate side, I mean, I know Google's brand new campus is filled with things like rainwater capture off their roofs. And obviously that's out of necessity, but maybe that kind of sets the example for new facilities or new campuses that are being built throughout the rest of the country.
Yeah. And I mean, as we primarily talk about California, San Francisco is really, you know, gone out of its way. And I think I've talked about this, whether it be on the Future of Water, but also on Dave McGimsey's podcast, the Water Values podcast, and that is San Francisco. They've implemented a policy several years ago. It was any new property or facility that was built over 250,000 square feet was mandated or obligated to install on-site water reuse and treatment. And so the Salesforce Tower, which is, if that's the poster child of that policy, is one example. But since then, they've actually, I believe it was either late 2021 or early this year, I can't recall exactly, that they've reduced that square footage requirement down to, I think, is it 100,000 square feet? So they're turning the screw, and there are advantages to cities doing this. And I think that's the, you know, the driver to a municipality or a government entity, county level, state level, whoever's in charge of the water supply and really the assets, is in some cases population may be increasing or demand pressures on the infrastructure assets are growing. So the auto response is, well, we're reaching a certain threshold, therefore we just need to add more capacity, you know, wastewater treatment capacity and water treatment capacity. Well, I think what San Francisco has done is they've looked at it more holistically and said, if we can get the stakeholders to reduce the demands and or on the services, whether it be water supply or wastewater treatment, then it lowers the need or reduces the short-term need for any capacity additions. And capacity additions mean money. And so that's a huge, it's a thoughtful way of doing it. I'm not going to say it's perfect, but you know, it's difficult when the market landscape is so fragmented, everybody's doing their own thing. If everything was centralized, would it be easier? Nah, possibly, but that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. And I think these stopgap solutions have been kind of plagued nationwide and across any kind of, you know, utility sector. It's always, what's this quick fix that we can do now, because it's hard to think long-term when things are happening in real time. But yeah, I think there's a long way to go there. Can we bring this into, speaking of other kind of utilities, I mean, just the interconnectivity between water and energy. And if we want to talk about California some more, I mean, the decreasing levels of these major reservoirs that are providing hydroelectric power to millions of people, right, in the dams. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think that if anything was the catalyst to this recent research we put out was exactly that. And the reason for that was, you know, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the levels are going down dramatically. I mean, everybody's seen the rings, but what people don't realize is you look at it on a photograph, you look at these white rings, you're like, oh, wow, that's a lot. They've gone down like 80 to 100 feet. Well, that's like, we're talking like 7 to 10 stories, right? I mean, when you stand next to a building and say water levels have dropped by this much, it's pretty incredible. But that being said, why else are we concerned about this? Because if Glen Canyon Dam cannot produce, generate power because water levels are so low, because, you know, the water intake is above the water level, then there are tens of millions of people that could and or will be impacted by potential rolling blackouts or brownouts. I've lived in California during brownouts. It was a wholly different story. Those were the Enron days. But the issue is, you know, from a water perspective, at least through the lens that we see it, is that, do all utilities have backup power? Are they insulated from not only the risks of not having the power, and sure, they may have diesel generators on site, they may have more sophisticated microgrids in place, and I know there's battery storage and things like that being deployed. But, you know, everybody's looking, you know, down the road and saying, oh boy, there are going to be wildfires. And there have been lawsuits. There have been instances where utilities have been, wastewater utilities have been held accountable for not being able to provide service because of what I would call force majeure events. And so that is a challenge in and of itself. And so, you know, this interconnectivity, we saw it happen with the winter storm in Texas. Was that last year, 2 years ago? Time flies when you're having fun, I suppose. But we're seeing utilities in Texas also implementing in places like Houston, putting in on-site power generation through battery storage or gas backup to prevent or provide resiliency to climatic events.
So this is kind of a broader question, but why the emphasis on what's happening in California? I mean, why should we are a global market research firm? Why do we care enough to put out a research note and have a whole podcast on what's happening in California? Is it just because the population of California is that of a small country? Is it because these are kind of telling signs of perhaps what's going to happen in other regions?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, we're from the East Coast. We, you know, I think this wouldn't be the first time that we said if California wants to drift off into the Pacific and be done with it. Yeah, you know, that's the sort of the East Coast. Yeah, East Coast, West joke, West Coast joke. But I'm sure they feel differently about us as well. But that being said, it's the most obvious example in the U.S., despite all of the abundance, all of the resources. I mean, California in and of itself is, depending on how you measure it, some argue that it's the sixth largest economy in the world, right? There are 36 million people that live there. It's also one of, if not the most productive agricultural region in the world. So it has a major economic impact, not only on the U.S., but on the world. And like anything else, whether it be renewable power or, you know, is a good example, what happens in places like California, and environmental regulations would be another, can be an indicator or a bellwether to what is going to happen in the rest of the U.S. For water, it is, along with the rest, with the Western U.S., is somewhat unique from where many of the federal policymakers, in fact, are located. But I think you're right. It's demonstrative or another global example, whether it be Australia or South Africa and Day Zero. I mean, they've been through it with Cape Town over the past couple of years. So it's an indicator where there are resources and technologies that can be deployed to showcase, here's how it can be. Look, the U.S. is by volume, is the largest provider of reclaimed or reused wastewater by volume. Much of that is, in fact, in California. Do they need more of it? Yes. But I think that's a big reason why it is an indicator of what can and maybe shouldn't be done, depending on your side of the argument.
Right. Yeah. Can we end this on a sanguine note? I mean, do you see opportunities? Are you hopeful about certain solutions or the social aspect of all this?
I absolutely am. I think I've sort of been on this train for a while where, and maybe this is where we got into it, was asking about the domestic water users and voluntary mandates. The question is, are they educated enough to understand the implications of, you know, water usage? You know, do they have a swimming pool? Do they water their lawn? Do they care? But really the title change really might happen at the commercial and or industrial level, because there are financial implications for both, notable financial implications for them, both rising cost of water, rising cost of wastewater treatment. But there's also then the ESG. This is an ongoing debate, even internally at Bluefield, if you follow Elon Musk, he says that ESG is, you know, a bunch of baloney. And he's right in some ways, but the bottom line is, I think there are companies that are seeing financial drivers for some of their decisions, whether it be to address carbon, which therefore impacts water supplies and or water usage and vice versa. So I think there is opportunity. So, and I think, you know, more recently, I know one of our analysts who put something out back to the domestic water users, like home builders, right? Why are they building homes? Or should they be building homes, a better way to put it, without smarter, more efficient water systems and water management systems within the new build? Absolutely, that's the case. So we're seeing firms like KB Homes doing agreements with these smart water household water management firms and software companies. So yeah, there is a lot happening. I think it can be frustrating without a doubt, but hey, you know, what are we going to do about it? I mean, we don't have an alternative. So, and that's not to say that the East Coast, as we talk about the West, East Coast has its own water problems. We've got stormwater problems. We've got water quality problems, whether it be PFAS or lead, leakage problems. And one thing we didn't talk about in California is actually leakage rates in California are pretty low. So relative to the rest of the country. So, you know, if they're in the 10 to 12% range for California, you know, we're seeing, I think the US average is 17%. So, hey, kudos to California. That's cheap water right there, quite honestly. So there are opportunities there as well.
Well, that's it. That's it from my end. I think we kind of covered the three main topics I wanted to get through, but I appreciate your insights.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do this. Thanks for, I actually should thank you for thrusting you into this position. So, but you know, like what we try to do on these things is kind of, as my father would say, chew the fat. So hopefully we've done a little bit of that.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Reese.
Thanks, John. We'll catch up later. Thanks. All right. So before we sign off, all I ask is that you please subscribe to The Future of Water and give us a review whenever you can, wherever you can. Send us a note with any questions, comments, concerns, or topics you'd like us to discuss at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. And always tell a friend about it. That'd be a big help to us and all the listeners out there. The more people that listen, the more we do. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Until we meet again, be well, be safe, and take care.